So this is the first sort of official class of a four-class series on... can you read that okay? That's a V at the beginning. Vijnana, say Vijnana. Bhairava. Tantra. It really should be Tantra, but everyone pronounces it Tantra, so... Vijnana. Vijnana means consciousness, as I said earlier. It's the same word for you Buddhists that is used for one of the five heaps. The heaps of consciousnesses, right? So you have ear consciousness, eye consciousness, and so forth. The consciousness that we're talking about here is mental consciousness. So the consciousness, Bhairava, means literally means the frightener. The frightener. And so it's a name for Shiva. Shiva, you know, is kind of scary. He can be kind of scary. Well, Shiva's the destroyer, you know. When Shiva starts dancing, you should head for the hills. Yeah, the dance of Shiva is the end of the world. So Bhairava means frightener, but it means it in a particular sense. It frightens away our fear. It's the frightener of fear. It's the frightener of those who frighten us. Okay? And then Tantra, as I mentioned earlier, you know, literally means spreading out, extending. So the consciousness, the God consciousness, you know, Shiva consciousness, Bhairava consciousness spreads out everywhere. There's no place where it's not. Another possible translation for Tantra in this context is method. Method. So the method for reaching, you know, Bhairava consciousness. The method for achieving God consciousness, or something like that. It's a text that's usually dated to about the 8th or 9th century AD. And it's a part of what's called the Kashmiri Shaivite tradition. Kashmiri Shaivite, which is a form of Hinduism. And don't worry, you don't have to learn a whole new kind of, you know, religion here. You know, I don't know that much about Kashmiri Shaivism myself. And it doesn't matter for our purposes, really. It's a great classical text of world spirituality, okay? And we can just, you know, take it and use it for our own purposes. And that's the case with all these texts nowadays, right? Bhagavad Gita, the Upanishads, the Quran, the New Testament, they're all world texts now. They're all global texts. And every text comes from an original context. But every text that survives has survived through many contexts. So this is just a new context. We at the ashram are providing a new context for the study of the Vijnana Bhairava Tantra. Okay? Yeah. It is, as I think I mentioned also earlier, the tradition of Kashmiri Shaivism is known as monistic. Monistic. M-O-N-I-S-T-I-C. Monistic. Which, you know, is radical unity, radical oneness. There's no the divisions between us and between us and the world are not real. They're not ultimately real. That ultimately everything is unified. Everything is one. All is one. You know, you've heard that. You know, and this is a tradition that you know kind of supports that. It's different for those of you who have studied Vedanta, for example. Vedanta. Another kind of Hindu philosophy, it's different from Vedanta in that. They're both monistic. But Vedanta believes that the world of differences, the world of appearances, is illusory. Maya, is illusion. And so the point is to kind of break through the illusion to see the oneness. This is a little bit different idea. This is the idea that the world of appearances and differences and the ultimate unity of things are two expressions of the same thing. They're not divorced, you see. So that's what Cindy was talking about earlier in terms of Shakti and Shiva. Shakti is the world of appearances. There is nothing in the world of appearances that is not Shakti, that is not the goddess. And then there's the God who is kind of sometimes regarded as the emptiness, the voidness, you know? So there's everything and then there's kind of nothing. There's the nothing that makes everything possible. But But the everything requires the nothing that makes everything possible too. So it's very similar to what some of you have studied in Buddhism, especially in something like the Heart Sutra. Form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. That's what it says in the Heart Sutra, right? Form means the world of appearances. And that means that the world couldn't appear as it does unless it were empty. So what does it mean to say that things are empty? It means that they do not exist independently. Things are empty of existing independently. And so things can exist only interdependently. Interdependently. So which means in a vast mesh network, connections. You see? So that's the plenitude side of things. The fullness, right, is the world of interconnection. Vast interconnections. Nothing excluded. And nothing existing on its own. Independently. See? So when you hear this, people say, you know, things are empty. If they know what they're talking about, that's the only thing that it means. That they are, things and beings are empty of existing independently. And therefore they do exist interdependently. So you could say Shakti is the world of interdependence. Shakti, the goddess, is the world of form. And Shiva is the world of the absence of independence. Of the voidness, you see. So the text plays with this quite a bit. The idea that God, you know, is both manifest and transcendent. That the ultimate is both manifest here in the world of appearances, everywhere. This is all God. There's nothing that's not God here. And then there's the transcendent God, the God that exists outside of appearances. And you can't know one without the other. You can't really know the world of appearances without understanding the voidness that makes the world of appearances possible. But you can't understand the voidness without understanding the world of appearances either. You can't know Shakti without Shiva, and you can't know Shiva without Shakti. They are two aspects of the same thing. So Vijnana Bhairava Tantra, the methods for reaching the consciousness, the understanding of kind of what I just said. And not intellectual, okay? This is no homeworks here, no quizzes, no grades, you see? Nothing to achieve here, no A's to get, or A minuses even, you see? It's not that kind of knowledge. It's not that kind of understanding. It's deeper. It's realization. It's a realization. Not just, data. Not just intellectual book knowledge, okay? That these methods are pointing to. They're trying to get us at that. So that's the basic sort of, you know, structure, really. That the deity, that the ultimate reality is both immanent and transcendent, is both here and now and sort of beyond here and now. And then there's, sometimes they say there's a mediating, in this structure, in this tradition, there's a kind of a mediating third. So there's the transcendent, there's the immanent, and then there's the intermediary. The intermediary between the transcendent and the immanent, between this world and what's beyond this world. And that's us. That's humans. Humans are the intermediary between Shiva and Shakti. The meeting place, you could say, between Shiva and Shakti. So that explains the first verse. We'll go through some of this technical stuff pretty quickly because, like I said, it's not our purpose here to become experts in Kashmiri Shaivism. Okay? It's our purpose to try to understand what this text is trying, the experiences that this text is trying to evoke in us. So we'll start. The teaching begins. So the first, I don't know how many, 20, 30 verses or so, is a setup, is the setting up, the context for the real teaching. The real teaching is Shiva teaching Shakti, the God teaching the goddess, 112 what they call dharanas. Cindy, would you mind? Dharanas is the word here for methods, techniques. It's a word for that some of you may know from the yoga tradition. It's the sixth of the eight angas. of the eight limbs of yoga. Dharana, jhana, samadhi. Those are the three meditation ones. Dharana. Yeah. And in the yoga tradition, it means something like fixation. Fixing your mind on something. And then jhana, meditation, means holding it there for a while. Fixing your mind on something, then the next step is holding it there. And samadhi is the goal of yoga. Samadhi, I like to translate as integration. Full integration of self and world. Self into world. So anyway, dharana means putting your mind on something. See? It just means that. It doesn't say how long, actually. The commentaries on the Yoga Sutra usually just assume it just means, momentarily even. It's dharana, means momentarily. Put your mind on something. Then jhana means holding it there longer. Keeping it fixed like that. So many of these techniques that we'll be learning are meditative techniques, but they don't require you to sit in, lotus position and concentrate for an hour and a half. It can just be instant, kind of like momentary. But in that moment, you discover Bhairava consciousness. In that very moment. So anyway, that's the main part of the text, is these 112 techniques. So the first part is kind of just the setup for it. The glorious goddess said, Devi is the name for goddess, and Uvacha means said. The glorious goddess said, O God, so she's talking to Shiva here, I have heard the entirety of the teaching on the threefold division of Shakti, transcendent, intermediate, and immanent. Which I just kind of talked about, right? I've heard hours and hours and hours of teaching on that. You've heard 5 minutes on it. But Shakti's saying, I've heard just, countless teachings on the, on the theology, the intellectual stuff of this tradition. And the quintessential portion of everything that has been produced by Rude, should be a by there, and his consort. And in other words, she's making mention of a very important text in this tradition called the Rudyamala Tantra, of which the Vajjana Bhairava Tantra is a part. So that's all technical stuff. Basically what she's saying is, I've studied all the scriptures. I've studied all the, the intellectual stuff that I'm supposed to study, as part of my religious training. She's like a lot of us, actually, who spend, years and years, studying texts and, learning the rules and regulations and techniques and so forth. And then she says in the next verse, but even now my doubts have not dissipated, Supreme Lord. Even now I don't quite get it. Now look, she's the goddess, okay? She gets it. She's just pretending. So the whole thing's just a setup. Who doesn't get it? We don't get it. Okay? So Shakti is standing in for us. Right? It's just a play. Like Cindy was saying, it's just like a drama, like a passion play or something like that in the Christian tradition. So she's claiming to have doubts. But, what has she said before? I've studied forever. I've studied all this stuff. I've gone into the deep layers of the curriculum, the spiritual curriculum, the scriptures. I've done all my ACI courses. I got 100 on all the quizzes and homeworks, and I still don't get it. I still have doubts, samshaya. And we all have doubts. We all have doubts if we rely on our intellect alone. Because the intellect is kind of a doubting machine, actually. If it hasn't reached the heart, if it hasn't reached your deeper being beyond the head, you'll always have doubt. Always say, I don't know, maybe there's some new stuff that will come along later that will prove all this wrong, Maybe I'll find a better tradition to study, cooler texts, There's always that kind of opening in the mind, isn't there? Like, maybe a better teacher will come along, It's kind of like I've heard nowadays that people who use dating services on the internet, they have lots of doubt about, you know, the people, because they always think, well, there's 5,000 other ones on there. Maybe I got, you know, the crappy one. Maybe I should just go back and try again. There's so many choices, you know. Too many choices. So, you know, she's kind of saying that about the intellect, you know. There's so many different, you know, ins and outs that the intellect can do. Now, so we always will have doubt. Always will have doubt spiritually if we rely only on our intellect. So then she says, she sort of pops the question. Many of the texts that come out of India, Buddhist and Hindu alike, are based on a question. Right, they proceed from a question. Diamond Cutter Sutra, the Heart Diamond Cutter Sutra, Heart Sutra also, in the Buddhist tradition. I'll start with a question. What is your real form, O God? What is your rupa tattva? Tattva means real. Rupa means form. How do I know you? Who are you? You know? Where are you? What do you look like? You know? What's your real form? And then she says, O Lord, favor me with your prasada, grace. And grace is the opposite of intellect, actually, right? She says, I've got a real good intellect. I studied all these texts. I've mastered the scriptures and so forth. Favor me with some grace here, you know? Download some grace. In other words, it's a kind of a surrender. It's a kind of a surrender. Saying, I can't figure it out. I can't figure it out on my own. Can't figure it out with my own IQ. You know, no matter how high your IQ is. And in fact, the higher your IQ, the more likely it is that you know that you can't figure it out. This comes from many, many years in the academic world. There's like two kinds of academics. There's bad academics who think they know everything. And then there's really good academics who know how much they don't know. The better, you know, the smarter you are, the more versed in any material that you are, the more you know that you don't know. And it provides a little bit of humility. And if you don't get to that point, you're not very good, you know. You're a wise ass. You just know it all kind of thing. So, you know, she's asking for a favor. She's asking for something unearned. Because that's what grace is, right? Unearned. I didn't work for it. I didn't, you know, study for it. I didn't labor for it. Just by grace, you know, give it to me. You know, surrender. Surrendering yourself to something higher. You know, she's playing. She's as high as he is, actually. She's the same as he is, actually. But she's playing, like, she's showing us how to be a good disciple. She's showing us how to be a good disciple. By studying. You know, she mentions in the very first verse that she spent a lot of time studying. So it doesn't say, just don't learn anything and just, like, give me some grace, okay? Does not say that. You can't, as I was saying to people at dinner, you can't unlearn something unless you've learned it. So it's a process. It's like climbing a ladder. You move up one rung at a time. And part of any good spiritual training is learning the stuff, learning the rules and regulations, learning the data, learning the theologies and the scriptures and the dogmas and doctrines, and learning it. But then letting go. As you reach higher rungs of the ladder, you know? You don't just stay at one rung. And if you have a good teacher, a good teacher will not let you sit on the same rung forever, you know? And the student hates it. Because we love our rungs, you know? We get used to them, you know? We feel stable on our rung. We got to this rung and then we got real comfortable in it. And then the teacher says, well, climb higher. I said, No, I like my, you know, holding on to it, right? So a good teacher will always be kicking your ass. Always be taking away, you know, pulling the rug out from underneath you. Because grasping onto rugs will not get you enlightenment. Grasping onto the rugs. Who was it? Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche said, the the bad news is that you're free-falling out of like an airplane. You know, your bad news is that you're free-falling. The good news is there's no ground. So, you know, a teacher tries to put you in that space of free fall, with the hope that you'll have the faith that, you know, you're not going to go splat, because there is no ground. It's just all free fall, actually. And that's freedom. Notice the free in free fall. And freedom doesn't come from grasping. It doesn't come to holding on to your rungs or not jumping out of the airplane. So, by... please grace me, favor me with your grace, and cut away every single doubt. And then Bhairava comes in. Bhairava said, sadhu, sadhu, in Sanskrit. Where have you heard that before, Buddha heads? It's in the Dhammakaya Sutra, it's in the Heart Sutra. It's what the teacher will say to a student who's asked a good question. Good. Very interesting in these texts that this phrase, sadhu, sadhu, right you are, you know, that's right. Good, you know, good on ya. Good on yas. It's interesting that they say that in regard to the question, not to like to some answer that you came up with, right? It's the questions that count. It's the good questions that we ask that are important, not the answers that we think we have. And we all think we have answers. We all think we have the answers. And so it seems to me that one of the most important phases in a spiritual career is to stop thinking that you have all the answers and start asking questions. And ask good ones, too. Not like, you know, what's your favorite color? You didn't ask Bhairava, what's your favorite? He says, you know, who are you? You know, how can I see you? What's your real form? That's a good question, you know. In the Buddhist texts, in, Diamond Cutter Sutra and the Heart Sutra, the question tends to be, how should I live? What should I do? You know, what am I supposed to do here? Which is also a good question, right? A good question. Here's another one. Who am I? That's a real good question, you know. And that's a question that we don't ask enough. You know, because we think we know the answer already. But then when we're actually forced to give an answer to a question like that, who am I, it becomes very, very difficult to articulate the answer. So we think we have the answer, but really, we don't know at all. So it would be a good question to ask. Who am I? That's another way of thinking about the question that the goddess pops is, really, who, not only who are you, but who am I? Because they're the same thing. Right you are, my dear. This question of yours is tantrasara, the very essence, the very core, the pith. You know that word pith? P-I-T-H? The very pith of tantra. It's a really good question. So then he says, blessed one, although it is most secret, I'll nevertheless tell you. A lot of texts that were most secret are readily available to us. Have you noticed that? No. You know, and you can find out pretty much anything you want about any esoteric tradition in the world's religious traditions online. You know, just Google it. You know, Tantra, Google it, and you'll probably pull up a lot of bullshit, but, you know, there is some stuff, good stuff on it, available to anyone, right? The Bhagavad Gita, by the way, presents itself in exactly the same way, for those of you who know that text. In the 18th chapter, Krishna tells Arjuna, this is really secret stuff I just told you, you know. And he's presenting this text too. It's secret. It's supposed to be kept secret. It's supposed to be esoteric. So they say in tantric traditions that tantra keeps itself secret. So you don't need to. It's okay that everything's on the internet, because unless you really know it, you don't know what the hell they're talking about. And this text could be very easily understood that way too, as just a bunch of gibberish, a bunch of like childish gobbledygook. As you'll see, I mean, some of the dharanas, some of the techniques are very, very simple, very simple. And so So you could say it's kept itself secret from those who don't understand what those simple techniques are getting at. So, you know, getting a teaching on it is kind of important, getting some understanding, some interpretation. You can't just pick up texts like this and read them on your own and understand it, really. They keep themselves secret. Although it is most secret, I will nevertheless tell it to you. Whatever has been stated to be the divisible form of Bhairava, and then move on to the next verse, that is to be regarded as insubstantial. This was my best translation of a word that means something like doesn't have any worth to it, doesn't have any solidity, no firmness to it, insubstantial. So what is he saying here? Anytime you try to separate Bhairava from anything else, anytime you try to divide God up from anything else, that is false. That is illusory. And then he says quite clearly it's illusory. It's insubstantial, O goddess, like Indra's net. Indra's net is a metaphor that's used in a lot of Indian texts. The idea being that Indra, who's kind of this sort of cosmic god, has a net, and at each of the nodes of the net is a mirror that reflects all the other nodes of the net. Do you get the image? You know what I'm talking about? Like every little, you know, kind of point of the net reflects every other point of the net. So it's kind of like a house of mirrors or something, cosmic house of mirrors. So it's like Indra's net, like an illusion, Maya, or a dream, Svapna, just like a dream, a mirage, Upama, or like a city of ghosts in the sky. This is exactly the language, exactly, that Nagarjuna uses, for those of you who care, in his root verses on the middle way. That the idea that things have some kind of independent existence is an illusion, is a complete illusion. It's like a dream. And so he's saying here that the idea that God can be separated out from anything, that there is something that is not God, is just an illusion, just a fantasy. All duality, you know? Duality, this, that, up, down, right, left, black, white, all duality ultimately is illusion. It isn't really like that. And the reason for that, you know, isn't that everything is just one big mush of oneness? That's not what it means. Non-dual is not what that means. Non-dual or oneness. Non-dual means that the things that we see as opposites, polarities, can't exist without each other. There's no black until and unless there's white. And there's no white until and unless there's black. Right? Black has no independent existence without white. White has no independent existence without black. See? But does it seem that way? You know, no. I mean, to us it seems like there are things out there on their own, independently, that can exist without dependence on something else. I'll give you my favorite example right from the top, okay? This is a visible object, right? For everyone who's not blind, this is a visible object, right? The visible object does not exist independently as a visible object. Impossible. Why? Because the visible object needs a seer to see the visible object for it to be a visible object, right? In what sense would it be to say there's a visible object that no one sees? See? Right? It would be an invisible visible object. Because no one, invisible means you don't see it. No one sees it. So the visible object depends on a seer who sees the visible object for it to be a visible object. Right? Okay, now the next shoe that drops. And the seer depends on a visible object for the seer to be a seer. You're not a seer all by yourself. Not, what do you say? I'm a seer, don't see anything. Right? For the seer to be a seer, the seer has to see a visible object. And for the visible object to be visible, the visible object has to be seen by a seer. Okay, so far? Now, ready for this? And neither one can come first. Neither one can come first. There can't be first the visible object that then is seen. Because that would be a visible object that wasn't seen by somebody. Right? And there can't be a seer who then sees something. Because that would be a seer who doesn't see anything. And then sees something. The seer is made to be a seer by seeing a visible object, and a visible object is made visible by a seer seeing it. And you can run that through all five senses. And that's how the world exists. And the world does not exist in any other way than that. Okay? So that's what non-duality kind of really means. Yeah. No, non-duality means that there, in a sense, there are no two things here. There are no two separate things here, seer, invisible object, because they are linked inextricably, necessarily. Can't be one without the other. And neither one can come first. That's the key one, right? Neither one can come first. So in our ignorance, we think, oh, there's visible objects all around, and then I see them. Right? If you don't believe me, do a little thought experiment. If we all left the room, would this visible object still be here as a visible? If we all left the room, nobody seeing. Well, you know, everyone's got the right answer now. No. But of course, I mean, ordinarily we think, of course, there's all kinds of visible objects here in the temple. And then we come in and see them. And they're sitting there waiting as a visible object, you know, waiting for someone to see me. Hi, I'm a visible object. Are you going to come in and see me soon? Right? But the visible object is made to be a visible object when it's seen by a seer. And the seer is made to be a seer when the seer sees a visible object. And the hearer and the smeller, is there a sound that isn't heard by a hearer? See, remember that old sort of joke, paradox, riddle? If a tree fell in the bush and was no one there to hear it, would it have made a sound? Obviously not. If there was no one there to hear it, in what sense could you say it was audible? Obviously, this is an easy one. Give me a harder one than that. Tree falling in the forest, nobody hears it. Obviously not, right? But we don't think this way. See, when you think about it, then you realize the world can't exist the way it seems to. Even just a little bit of like 5-10 minute experiment on visible objects and seers and stuff like that can't exist the way we think it does. It can only exist interdependently. Everything connected to everything else. It's the only way. And that's the only way that we can exist also as individuals. Only connected to other beings, other things. We are not alone. We have never been alone. Cannot be alone, you see. Always in relationship. Never outside of relationship. So, how did I get off on that? What was I talking about?
The illusion.
Oh, yeah, duality. So, you know, when you hear this non-dual thing, you know, I really think it's a mistake to start going into some, you know, void of, you know, of mushiness and thinking that that's what they mean by non-dual or, you know, monistic or, what's really meant was that everything is in the nexus of oneness. Everything is in the same nexus. It's like we're all in the same network. The whole universe is in the same network. And there are no nodes in the network. There are no nodes. You know what a node is? Like a point that's then connected to other things. Because that point is a point when it's connected to other things. It's not a point and then is connected to other things. You see what I mean? Yeah. So anyway, we're getting there now, right? Getting down and dirty now, right? Deep end of the pool already. You know what they say about religion, right? I'll tell my favorite joke. Religion's like a swimming pool. All the noise is coming from the shallow end. All the disputes, all the debates, all the I'm right, you're wrong, all of that is like children playing in the shallow end. And in the deep end, it gets real quiet. He has been so portrayed as different. You know, like Shiva is portrayed as you know, got a big top knot, sort of like Andrew's, except for there's like a whole Ganges River in it. You know, and he's got like arms and legs and stuff like that. Yeah, images, right? I have found out several years ago what God looks like. You know, the Western God. God looks exactly like what you thought he does. I went to a mission in Southern California. I forget exactly where. Oh, Capistrano. Where the birds, there's a song about that, the birds come from Capistrano or something like that. Anyway, so I went to this mission, Christian mission, and they had a refrigerator magnet that had God's picture on it with Jesus next to him. Jesus, you all know what he looks like. But God, you know, I was kind of always wondering, what does God look like? And sure enough, he looks just like you thought. He's like an old hippie. He's got like long white hair, long white beard, and he's kind of like stern looking. You know, it's a picture. It's a depiction of God. And similarly, any kind of like statues or, you know, pictures of God, they're just for children, he says. These are just for children, you know, to think that you could depict God as having long white hair, you know, or being a man or a woman, or having so many arms, you see, to delimit your understanding of God that way. I mean, it's useful for kids. It's useful for the spiritually immature to hold on to something like this. But that's not God. That can't be really God. He has been so portrayed only to add to the meditation of people with confused intellects. Practitioners of ostentatious rituals. That's kind of, I'm proud of that translation. Kriya Dambara. Dambara means loud. So, and Kriya means, you know, rituals or rites. So people are very ostentatiously, you know, doing their pujas and their services and all of that, you know. So he's been so portrayed to aid the meditations of such people who are stuck in conceptual thought. Okay, this is the Sesame Street word. You remember though, Sesame Street always had a word that was, this episode was brought to you by? This retreat has been brought to you by Vikalpa or near Vikalpa, because we'll see this word over and over and over again. Vikalpa means conceptual thinking. Vikalpa. And the purpose of these dharanas that this text is going to be teaching us is to get to near Vikalpa. Near Vikalpa means non-conceptual. And you can say non-conceptual thought. Because it's still, you know, it's still thinking of some sort. It's deep thinking. But it's non-conceptual. It's thinking without the aid of words. If you think about it, so to speak, when you're thinking, you're always thinking in words. Conceptually. That's what conceptual thinking means, is that words, labels, concepts, you know. And so this text, like many, many others, especially the more, you know, the deeper text, the higher text of traditions, very, very commonly say that the ultimate, the divine, the deepest levels of reality are not available to language. You can't capture them in language. They are beyond language. In the deep end of the swimming pool, it is silent. Silence, by the way, is a kind of an emptiness, isn't it? It's a kind of an emptiness. It's the emptiness of sound. There's no sound. Yeah. So these are all just, you know, people stuck in conceptual thought. All just understandings of the deity, huh? For people who are stuck in conceptual thought. Like tales to frighten children. Or treats given by a mother. All these have been taught for the purpose of the advancement of those of inferior intellect. So he's just kind of dismissed pretty much all of religion. All of ordinary understanding of religion. It's a wonderful way of thinking about what religion is, actually. It's like frightening or rewarding. You know? It's either like tales of hell or, you know, what's going to happen to you in bad karma. Or, you know, God's going to spank your bottom or something like that. Tales to frighten you. Or tales like mommy giving like little, you know, treats out. You know, well, if you're a good girl, you know, you'll get this and you'll get that and like that. These are all just children's tales. All of this kind of understanding of religion is just like for children. I love texts like this. I love texts that undermine religion. Religious texts that undermine religion. In order to try to get to the truth, you know, in order to try to get deeper. He is free. Now he's talking about himself here. God. He is free. Ultimate reality. If you don't like God, anyone here really have an objection to the word God? Do you mind if I use God as a word? I found that in Australia especially, people kind of start twitching when you say God. But, you know, that's just another word too, right? It's a word for something that can't be captured in language. So if you don't like that word, you know, think about ultimate reality or, you know, the deeper nature of things, or, you know, something that will work for you. But I think generally I'll be relying on God because I grew up with that. I grew up with that being the word for it. Yeah, anyway. He is free from being in any place or time and cannot be particularized by having a certain location or designation. God has no place. Or you could say God has every place, all places. God is in no time, no particular time. God is infinite, you know? Eternal and infinite. Ultimate reality is indescribable. Akatya. Katya and kat means a tale, kata. Kata means a tale or a story. You can't tell any real story about God. Akatya. Or you could say any story that you tell about God is just a story. See, just a fable, just a myth. Ultimate reality is indescribable and cannot be signified. You can't put a word on it. You can't designate it. The blissful experience in one's own innermost self is accessible only when conceptual thought ceases. You can cut that out and put it on your refrigerator with a magnet. The blissful experience, the ananda, in one's own, you know, everyone here at this ashram is called Ananda. Did you know that? They all have Ananda names. There's Atma, Swami Atma, something Ananda, Mukta Bodha Ananda, Layananda. They're all Anandas. They're all blissed out here. They all got the bliss. The blissful experience in one's own innermost self, in one's Atman. Atman is a word for the true self. Atman does not mean that. Individual ego. Doesn't mean yourself. Sometimes they translate it as self, Atman. But when they translate it as self, they usually capitalize it. Capital S self. Not the small S self. Not the little you. Not the ego you. But your true nature. Your true selfhood. Which, by the way, is no different than any other being's true selfhood. It's not distinguishable. It's not distinct. It's not separable. See? It's generalizable. It's the nobody who is everybody at the same time, or everybody who is nobody at the same time. So the blissful experience in one's own innermost self is accessible only when you stop thinking, when you stop the self-consciousness, which is the only self that you really have as an individual, is your self-consciousness. The you and the me that we think we have as individuals is maintained through self-consciousness. In other words, when you say your name to yourself, it doesn't designate anything except for a name. It's just a name. See? Who are you? When you say your name to yourself as an individual, who are you? You can go looking for yourself. It's like looking for Wally. It's like going looking for Wally, only it's the Wally from hell, because Wally ain't there, actually. Y'all know Wally? Find Wally, go find Wally. What's that thing called? Where's Wally? See, where's you? You see, you know, we say our names to ourselves, and then we think that that designates something. That there's somebody in there somewhere. Me, a little me in there, a little mini-me, like Mike Myers' mini-me's. Little mini-me in there somewhere. But that me's not there. It's an illusion. Can't find it. Even the neuroscientists now have given up trying to find HQ, headquarters, you know. There's no such thing. It's just function. It's just change. It's just, you know, process. There's no entity there. See? So we grasp onto something that's a complete illusion when we think of ourselves as being someone, really. See? Just a name. Name for a constantly changing process. Yeah, are you? Let's check, shall we? You know, when we say our names to ourselves, we usually think of ourselves as embodied, right? I am, you know, me, because I'm embodied. I have a body. Is the body a changing thing or an unchanging thing? What do you think? Is it a single thing or a multiple thing? How many parts does the body have? 100? 5,000? As many as you want until you get sick of counting? Right? So where's the unitary self, the me that I think exists, unchanging me, if I'm my body? What about my mind? Is your mind changing or unchanging? How often does it change, do you think? Once in a while? It's constantly changing, all the time. Is your mind one thing or many things? You could say it's many things, right? You have memories, you have feelings, you have the ability to discriminate between one thing and another, you have consciousness, all kinds of things going on in the mind. So where's the self? Where's the unitary self? The unitary unchanging self that we think, where's Wally? That's Wally. Wally is a unitary unchanging self that we think our names refer to. And it's not there. It's not there. It's an illusion. So the only self we have is self-consciousness. You could say, in fact, it's much truer, much more accurate, instead of saying I have a self, to say I am self-conscious. I have a consciousness of a self. But that's all the self that there is as an individual self. So this text is about replacing the self-consciousness that we have with Bhairava consciousness, which is unchanging, unitary, and eternal, as opposed to the little imaginary self that we have, which is constantly changing, constantly divisible, infinitely divisible. You know, we change our identity kind of on a moment-to-moment basis. When you come out to the ashram, I bet you you're a different person than when you were sitting around, you know, at home with your mom, you know? Or with your sisters that you grew up with, right? You become a different kind of person here. Much more spiritual, right? much less likely to, you know, argue and fight and stuff like that. Ram Dass once said, if you think you're enlightened, spend a week with your family. He is free from being in any place or time. Ultimate reality can't be described. The blissful experience of one's own innermost self is accessible only when conceptual thought ceases. The true self of Bhairava. So he's now finally answering her question. What's your true form? What's your true self? Who are you? The true self of Bhairava is Bhairavi. Bhairavi is another name for Shakti or the goddess. The true ultimate reality is no different from manifest reality. That's one way of understanding. The transcendent is no different than the immanent. The true self of Bhairava is Bhairavi, whose state is the appearance of plenitude. This is the first appearance of this word that I've translated as plenitude. You can translate it as fullness too. Bharita. And the text is constantly playing with this idea of plenitude versus emptiness. You can see it as full plenitude, or you can see it as empty. It comes to the same thing. They are the same, two different ways of describing the same reality. You can say it, everything is ultimate reality, or you could say reality is the absence of every appearance. And it's the same thing. It means the same thing. Two different ways of talking about the same thing. One negative, one positive. So you say, I am everything. I am all things. You know, Bhairava could say, I am in all manifestations. Or you can say, I am in none of them. I am not any one of them. And I'm not all of them even put together. Transcend that. See? Either nothing or everything. If, you know, it's kind of like that in philosophy, isn't it? If you can say that that things are empty of having any true nature. Or you can say everything has the same true nature, and that means the same thing, doesn't it? It means pretty much the same thing. What it doesn't mean is that some things have a nature different than other things. That isn't true. But you can say nothing has any true nature, or you can say everything has the same true nature, and that means the same thing, really. It's like, if you go far enough to the right, you'll end up on the left. There is always a unity between Shakti and the possessor of Shakti, between the goddess and the god, between Shiva and Shakti. So it is that that which is real is the same as that which possesses what is real. Shiva is the same as Shakti. The highest Shakti is the true self of the highest one, Bhairava. So in other words, there's no difference between the world of appearances and the world of ultimate reality. That's kind of basically what he's saying. No difference. For one who enters the state of Shakti, there is a feeling of undifferentiation. A feeling of undifferentiation. That's Bhairava consciousness. The feeling of oneness. It's like we are all waves, right? We are all individual waves in the same ocean, right? And it's when we understand our oceanness and that we realize that the wave has never been different from the ocean. Is the wave the same as the ocean or different from the ocean? It looks different from the ocean, right? It looks like it has some individuality. It arises, just like you, just like me. It arises, it lasts for a while, it crests, and then it goes back to where it came from. And that's our individuality. But it comes from the same ocean and it goes back to the same ocean. It undifferentiated. The ocean is undifferentiated, you know? Just one big amorphous mass of water. And then it like takes form, takes shape, takes wave-like shapes. But the wave comes from the ocean, goes back to the ocean, and ultimately the wave is not different from the ocean, right? The wave is just the ocean taking form. The ocean in motion. And so that's what he means. This feeling of undifferentiation. Freud called it that, actually. The oceanic feeling. The oceanic feeling that mystics, you know, have. And that we all have at some point or another. This feeling of being lost, transcendent. Transcended into the oneness, into the whole, right? Losing ourselves in something greater. For one who enters the state of Shakti, there's a feeling of undifferentiation. Such a one then becomes the very form of Shiva. It is said in this context that Shakti is Shaivimukham, the very face of Shiva. So the world of appearances is the face, the appearance of Shiva in form, manifest, right? No difference. Just the form that Shiva takes, just the wave that Shiva emerges, that pushes up from his own amorphous ocean. There's a commentary on this verse. It says, "Unless you ignore your individuality, universality will not arise in you." Unless you ignore your individuality, unless you transcend your individuality, universality will never arise. The recognition of universality. So, we are prevented from understanding our true nature, our real being, our real self with a capital S, by grasping to the individual self. By fully identifying with our ego, with our particularity, with our individuality. And it's only by letting that go that we get in touch with something universal and ultimate. Just as a lamp is known by its light, the sun by its rays, and the directions by their parts, so, dear one, is Shiva known by Shakti.
the commentaries say that this metaphor here, like lamp is known by its light, means a couple of different things. That there's no difference between the lamp and the light. Right? There's a lamp over there. Everyone can see it, right? The lamp and the light are the same thing, right? The light and lamp can't at one level be distinguished, right? There's no light without a lamp. There's no lamp without the light, right? A working lamp, anyway, right? So that's one thing he's saying about Shiva and Shakti, about manifest reality and ultimate reality. There really is no difference. Then he also says, the commentary also says, and the lamp can only be perceived by the light. If the room was completely dark, the light of the lamp would make the lamp visible. Right? In ways that it couldn't be before. So again, back to, from metaphor to what this is pointing to, is that we can understand God only through the appearances of the world. That we can see the lamp only through the light that the lamp emits, that the lamp shines. And then ultimately there's no real difference between the light and the lamp at all. So we understand God through the world of appearances, through each other, through experiences, through the visible world is looking at the face of God. You get the metaphor here? Yeah. It's a very beautiful understanding. Way better than thinking that God lives on Alpha Centauri. Sitting up there on some throne and you can't see him, but he can see you. And, maybe when you die, you'll flap, 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 flap up there and visit him or her. Everywhere, all around. We're looking, always perceiving the face of God. Always, never not. So then Devi speaks up again here. O God of gods, ornamented with the trident and skulls, talking about his accoutrement, that which is empty of place, space, and time, which cannot be designated, the state which has the form of the plenitude of Bhairava, the plenitude of Bhairava, the appearance of Bhairava. How is it found? What's the method for recognizing the truth that Bhairava is everywhere and always? She's asking for practice, really. She's asking for a practice. By what means? The word is upaya, for those of you who Buddha heads again. Upaya, usually in Buddhism, is translated skillful means. Method, means. By what means does the highest goddess become his very face? Tell me, Bhairava, in a way I can understand properly. Again, this is the Shakti, this is the goddess, she understands perfectly. Tell me in a way that they can understand perfectly, properly. See, we, the audience, right? So that's the setup. And then he gives 112 upayas. 112 dharanas, 112 methods, means for seeing Bhairava in this very world, in seeing Bhairava in your own world, seeing God. So we'll start tonight with a couple of them and then continue on for the next three classes with samplings from these. I've taken them not in order, but kind of thematically. There's some repetition in the texts, and they kind of like skip from one type of technique to another, so I tried to organize it a little bit, just for coherency. So tonight we'll start with dharanas, techniques, for finding your true nature, finding God within, through use of what is sometimes called the inner body, or the subtle body. Those of you who studied yoga should know something about this. Those of you who don't will learn. And so let's just start. It's probably easier to do. Here's the first dharana given in the whole text. This is pranayama, for those of you who know yoga. Pranayama, the yoga of using the breath. The Supreme One, whose very nature is creative, manifests as the upward moving energy, prana, and the downward moving energy, apana. By holding awareness at the place where the two begin, one can attain the state of plenitude. One can attain the state of Bhairava. So, the upward moving energy is the out-breath, and the downward moving energy is the in-breath. Is that right? Prana, apana. So, the method here is to try to concentrate on where they begin and end. So in this tradition, the idea is that they begin, somewhere around here. The outward breath, the inward breath ends there. And the outward breath ends with 12 fingers in front of your nose. 12 fingers? And two more. Okay? So you could just like try, to just like watch your breath and try to find where it is you think it begins and where it ends. Right? Each one of those places is both a beginning and an ending, right? The end of the out-breath is the beginning, is the place where the in-breath begins, and the end of the in-breath is the place where the out-breath begins. Isn't that right? And the place in between is the breathing. It's the activity. But this meditation is to, first of all, locate where that spot of beginning and end, where those two spots of beginning and end are. And then place your mind on them. Not on the breathing part. So what is it that you're placing your mind on when you're placing your mind on the beginning and end points, the two beginning and end points? It's a kind of a stillness. It's a kind of an absence of movement. It's a quiet. Just keep breathing naturally, but try to fix the mind on those two beginning endpoints. The first dharma. Too easy, right? Too easy. Because we're always doing it, right? We're always breathing. It's always there, always available. The next dharma kind of is very similar, but does a little bit of modification. Bhairavi, when the two breaths, the ingoing and outgoing, are prevented from returning, that is, are restrained, at the space where they end, the essence of what makes Bhairava Bhairava is found. So here he's talking about those same two points, and he's talking about the stillness of those two points of beginning and end, right? The beginning and end of the out-breath, the beginning of the out-breath, which is the end of the in-breath. So, beginning of the out-breath is the end of the out-breath, which is the beginning of the in-breath, and the end of the in-breath, which is the beginning of the out-breath. Those two points. Here he's saying, and pause there. Pause at those two places. So, some of you know this maybe from yoga training as a kind of a kumbhaka, a capsule practice. And You know, I'm told, I've never like actually seen this, but I'm told that there are like, you know, very radical ways of doing this. The way that I've always been taught is that you're supposed to do it very, very gently. Not holding the breath, not like getting to the point where you're gasping, you know, to take a new in-breath or something like that, but very gently relax until the stillness of those two points. So you want to try it? It's kind of late and we're all tired and stuff, so don't fall asleep. Keep breathing, by the way. Always good. So just watch your breath. Try to identify those two junctures where exhalation and inhalation meet. And then very, very gently, no effort, no stress, try to elongate a little bit the pause and place your mind there. Just relax into the stillness. Breath meditations are like often taught as very introductory meditations because they're so relatively easy. Because the object of meditation is always there. You can't really lose it. You can like daydream for a while, but you're still breathing, and then you notice, oh yeah, I'm still breathing. So it's a very good one. And the emphasis in these dharanas, in these methods, is not on the breathing. It's on the stillness between the breaths. It's on the interval. We'll see this kind of over and over again in the text in many different kinds of, enunciations. The emphasis on the middle, getting in between, getting in the middle between two kinds of activities and finding the peace and quiet between the two extremes. Here's another one. This one I don't know is included in the class, but it's another one that you can like do in your spare time if you want. Every thought that we have must have, in order to be a thought, a beginning, a middle, and an end. Right? Isn't that right? That's what we call a thought. That's what we call a moment, actually, right? A moment has a beginning, a middle, and an end. So, what's between the end of one thought and the beginning of the next thought? I mean, there has to be a gap there, right? Right? Otherwise, there wouldn't be an end. And if there weren't an end, there wouldn't be really a beginning either. So every thought, every moment, you can do it with moments too, you can do it with time, you can do it with pretty much anything. Everything has a beginning, a middle, and an end. So what's between the end of one thought and the beginning of the next thought? And put your mind there. And then you find Bhairava too. Then you find God too. Yeah. That's for eggheads. That's one for eggheads, is to sit around thinking about thinking and trying to understand that there must be a point between thoughts and try to find that point. Try to think your way into non-thinking. Concentrate on that which rises from the Muladhara chakra like the rays of the rising sun, and then gets subtler and subtler until at last it dissolves into the 12, which is a technical term for the Sahasra chakra at the top of the head. Cindy, you got a visual for me here?
What would you like?
The chakras. So, we don't have a whole lot of, don't have really a lot of time to go into these. I'm hoping that Cindy will maybe talk about them in her class a little bit, on the various sort of functions of the chakras, the main chakras. So this is a depiction not, you know, in this system there are 12 chakras, and, you know, definitely not going to go into the technicalities of all 12. This is a more standard understanding of the chakra. Chakra means circle or power point within the inner body. And there are six of them here, beginning. Muladhara is the one at the very bottom there. It's the, mula means root. And it's the root energy point of your inner body. So it's not like, you know, you could go to a surgeon and they'd cut you open and they'd find your Muladhara chakra down there by your bottom. It's a feeling. It's a feeling. It's a feeling of rootedness, of stability, down at the bottom, at the root, at your root. And then the next one is the Swadhisthana, is it? Which is, what, three fingers below the navel in the back.
In the system that we use.
Yeah.
Yeah, 3-4 fingers below the navel.
Look, this is just mapping of like somebody's understanding, you know, probably more than one somebody, understanding of, you know, kind of who you are on a feeling level inside. So it's kind of trying to talk about like energies or feelings, in, you know, kind of located inside of you, in the inside of you. And, you know, I think everyone's got a slightly different understanding of these. But this is kind of the map. And then the territory you have to kind of sort of look for, you know, yourself in your own kind of meditations and so forth. You want to say something about Swadhisthana?
Well, we're going to do the Bija mantras on when we do the experiential class. But,
okay.
We'll be doing the Bija mantras of the elements that you can relate to the chakras. So with the Muladhara chakra, we usually relate that to the earth, element of earth, because this is the more grounded aspect of ourselves and grounding down into your humanity. Because the upper chakras are more about our transcendence. You know, so the Muladhara is really important to ground down into that sort of earth element, to ground down into our humanity and, you know, basic humanness so that we don't transcend in a way that's detrimental. You know, we don't walk around with a Messiah complex because we also know that we're very human. So it's down near your bottom because that, like, always reminds you how human you are. You know? And then, so the Swadhisthana is a little, is up. Four fingers below the navel. The water element is with the Swadhisthana, and this is more of a sort of feeling aspect. You can tell too that the liquids are all held in this area, you know. So you can think about how you feel when you feel kind of sluggish, like the blood and the urine and the liquids down there feel sort of like a swamp. And then if we're, you know, doing the Bija mantras for the Swadhisthana, we'll try and kind of move the waters of the swamp to purify and clarify a little bit and get more in touch with our feelings and emotions. So that's the water element.
Next one is Manipura.
Manipura is the fire element.
Navel.
At the navel. This is sort of where your seat of power can be if you're not overcome by shame and fear of making mistakes. So it's this sort of fire in the belly to just keep moving forward in life without dampening your emotions, dampening your enjoyment, dampening yourself through shame and fear and that kind of thing.
It's where I locate also the beginning of anger in my own like feeling, you know, like the anger starts here and then it rises.
Yeah.
So the fire in the belly is, you know, has kind of two different potentials.
And you really can, I mean, one of the ways that you can feel the territory is that you can see what do you mean when you go, oh. So we're touching our chakras all the time, actually. Like, we're moving from these energetic spaces all the time. We just don't realize it. But, you know, we're touching our bodies all the time. So what do you mean when you go, or, you know, when you have anxiety and fear, there's some energy stuck in particular places, and you usually put your hands there. And we put them in the exact places that they locate the chakras. Here, nervous, maybe they won't like me, butterflies in the stomach, or, oh my God, so, I don't know what to do.
That's the next one, the heart chakra.
Yeah.
Anahata.
Love, afraid of love, you know, they won't love me. What do you mean when you go, or when you walk around like that, nobody loves me, you know? So you can feel this energy is moving us all the time, actually. There's so much information in the body and the posture and the hands and everything is trying to tell you which chakras are not allowing the energy to move through.
I love you so much.
I love you.
Well,
yeah.
You know, I feel you.
Feel you, man.
Feel you, man.
Yeah.
You're my brother.
Feel connected there. You know,
yeah.
Or here. Oh,
yeah,
oh my God.
That's the throat.
I'm such an idiot. I've never registered that. So why, you know, your voice is here. Oh, I just didn't know what to say. They're stuck here. The energy's stuck. So this is why we do the asana and the singing and all this work with the body to move all that energy through so that this doesn't get so stuck there, you know. Which, oh, by the way, this is connected to the air element, anahata.
The heart.
Yep. The heart. So the air moving through this way and this way. And then vishuddhi, we're getting more into sort of ether, space. This is at the throat chakra, which, you know, we open during the kirtana singing. Help our ability to communicate with each other on different levels. Ajna is the third eye. Yeah. And Sahasrara.
Top of the head.
Yeah. How can I be of service today? Being a vessel for the divine to come through.
So can you put back the slide of all six there?
Seven.
So, seven here. Yeah? Is it seven? So in this system is 12. And anyway, Dharana 2 and Dharana 5 are kind of similar. Dharana 2 here is saying, Dharana 5 and Dharana 6, I'm at. Dharana 5 is move the energy, sometimes called kundalini, up through those chakras one by one. And when you do that one by one, sequentially, it's supposed to open up the energy centers at each one sequentially until you reach the top, and then he says, and there's Bhairava. That's the Dharana 5. Dharana 6 is to do it, I got it the wrong way around. Dharana 5 is to do it suddenly. Dharana 6 is, because it says, Dharana 6 says, like lightning rising through the chakras one by one. Moving up until it reaches the three fists, which is another way of talking about the Sahasrara chakra. And at the end of the process, the great one appears. So, sorry, I messed it up a little bit. Number 5 is suddenly. Suddenly just open them all up. Bring that energy from bottom to top. And then number 6, starting with 6, is, you know, kind of meditatively one by one opening them up. The next one, I think Cindy's going to do in her class, so we can go through it kind of quickly. 12 are successfully broken open by means of the 12 associated syllables. So again, in this system, there are 12 chakras. We'll probably only be working with the 7. But with each one of these power points in the inner body, there is a sound associated with them. So this dharana says to concentrate your attention on those chakras by thinking about the sound that they supposedly make. Right? Having been liberated from the gross and subtle states, in the end, the highest state is Shiva. Next one. When the body is filled with that kundalini, with that energy, with that shakti, up to the crown of the head, having broken off the breath at the bridge formed by the contracted eyebrows, and suspending breath, so this means suspending breathing due to concentration on the Ajna chakra. Remember, the Ajna chakra is the one in the middle of the forehead, in a little bit. Like, can you feel where that little bump is on the top of your mouth? Everyone got one of those? Go up from there. Up from there and in from the, that's where your Ajna chakra is supposed to be. And this is a very common, it's a very common understanding to concentrate on that chakra for meditation purposes. It's kind of easy to find. I find. It's easy to find and just concentrate on that. This is a dharana that's concentrating on that spot. And having emptied the mind of conceptual thought. So don't think I am concentrating on my ajna chakra. Just like lose yourself in that space, in the inner body. Having emptied the mind of conceptual thought, the all-pervading one comes forth in the highest state of all. Dharana 28. Place the mind on the 12. Again, this is a mention of 12 chakras, so, you know, never mind 12. How about just 7? However and wherever you can. Yata, yata, yatra, tatra. All day long. Wherever you are, whenever you can. You know, kind of concentrate on these power points within. Each moment of the day. And as the turbulence of the mind, the vritti, the turbulence of the mind weakens. You should like cross out that around because that's a misprint. As the turbulence of the mind weakens, one becomes extraordinary. Vailakshanya means indescribably strange or different. So these are all dharanas about using the yogic inner body, the subtle body, to try to find, you know, your true nature. And these are the most technical of the dharanas in the Vijnana Bhairava Tantra. And, you know, maybe Cindy will go into it, maybe Andrew will go into it a little bit to help people who haven't been trained in this. But for the rest of you, don't worry about it too much. You know, for all of us, let's not worry about it too much, because there's a whole lot of other ones that don't require any kind of, you know, technical understanding of the inner body. But these ones are the ones that, you know, kind of deal with the inner body. So I thought we'd end tonight's class with a fun one that doesn't deal with the inner body per se, but I just threw it in anyway, under this heading. Oh Goddess, when one slowly moves the body, or sits on something that is moving, like a horseback, like one on a horseback, or I threw in motorcycle here because I like motorcycles, or in a moving car, the mind becomes calm and one enters the flow of divine inspiration. So this one also is about using the body. It's a more physical body this time. And here's how it's described, this dharana, so we can all do it a little bit. The dharana is describing a motion like this, or an up or down motion, like the horseback is up and down, or like this, a swaying back and forth. And, you know, even just doing this, you start to relax a little bit. Have you noticed that? I mean, you don't want to do this out in the streets of Melbourne that much. But here at the ashram, we can do it as much as we want, and nobody will care. Okay? So then close your eyes. And again, you know, you find that there's an end point on the right, there's an end point on the left, right? Just like with the breathing. Only this time we're not going to concentrate on the end and the beginnings, we're going to concentrate on the middle. So you've kind of used your body to kind of have a little frame or box between, you know, with two sides on it. And then concentrate your mind on the middle, between the left sway, end of the left sway and the end of the right sway. Put your mind in the middle there. And just relax. Don't think. Keep swaying. And just relax.
That's pretty good, huh? That feels good. It's my understanding that much of this inner body stuff with the chakras and the channels and the, you know, kundalini and stuff like that has kind of the same purpose of that dharana right there. To center you. To center you. To find your center. Madhya, they say in Sanskrit. Madhya means middle. And, you know, you can put that in all kinds of, like, technical language of getting the winds to enter, stay, and dissolve into the central channel or something like that, the prana, or to kumbhaka it and all of that. But it just means to find your center and put your mind there. So I think Cindy's going to do probably an even funner version of this dharana or a related one with maybe some music. Right? Is that tomorrow or next day?
Maybe it's Saturday.
One of the commentators on this text is someone called Satsangi, Swami Satsangi, who is a member of this lineage, of this ashram. And you can find her book at the library there, at the bookstore. And she's written a very, very good commentary on this text, verse-by-verse commentary. She says about, in relation to this one, she says that dancing has the same kind of effect, can have the same kind of effect. She says, some may even freak out on the dance floor. One can say they get a glimpse of that ecstasy, which if developed further, could even lead them to enlightenment. Bhairava can be found in the raves. No, I mean, this is the attraction of raves, or of any kind of dancing, really, is that you can lose yourself in it. You can lose the self-consciousness. If you're dancing self-consciously, you're not really dancing. You know? If you're going like this, and you're thinking, you know, is she going to like my moves? You know, thinking all the time, you know, how do I look? You know? That's not abandoning yourself. You see, you abandon yourself to the dance. And so that's another example of how we find ecstasy, we find bliss when we get ourselves out of the way. When we get the individual self out of the way and lose ourselves in something bigger. So that's kind of what she's pointing to with this, you know. What's happening to you actually, you know, at the rave? You know, what is that, you know, ecstatic feeling that you're feeling? And then she says, if you understand it, if you develop it, if you understand consciously what's going on, you know, not really consciously, you know what I mean? If you're conscious of it, you're not doing it. But, so you only can understand it, like, retroactively. You can think about what happened to you. Where was I? Where did I go on the dance floor, you know, when I was having such a good time? And then start developing some wisdom about what's actually happened there. You lost yourself. You lost your illusory little, you know, suffering self and found bliss. The bliss of being nobody.